Well, good morning. Or good afternoon. Is it morning still, or is it afternoon? I must confess, I've been to a number of different places in the recent past. I was, my wife and I were in Italy with the Baha'is in Italy at the Italian Baha'i School, which I highly recommend, by the way. Not only are the friends very charming, but the food is outstanding. But I was telling Jamshid that I've been too many places in a short period of time, and while I'm upright and ambulatory, I'm not necessarily sentient. You know, I just, you know, what's going on? Where are we? And what's happening? I want to say to Cynthia, I put my prayers on every morning, and particularly that prayer, which is a favorite of mine. It's a very long prayer, but you captured the essence of it, and I greatly appreciate the approach that you took to the musical articulation of such an important idea. I want to say a word about why I thought it was so important to have this gathering and why I was so pleased to have an opportunity to be with you. We are in the midst of one of the greatest transformations in human history. Profound changes are occurring in the structure of nations, in the relations among people, in our concept of what it means to be a human being and how we relate to others. And these changes are extremely complicated. And one of the difficulties we have is keeping track of where we are in that process of transformation and understanding what its dynamics are, and helping us to learn how we transform our own cultures. And by culture, I mean our habits of thought, our habits of feeling, and our habits of behavior. And so when our nation experiences a series of tragedies that are so profound and so arresting, it is time for us to reflect as communities and ask ourselves, how did we get here? What are the root causes of these tragedies? What inequities persist in our way of life that we need to correct? And what do we learn from these things so that we can build the kinds of communities that reflect the founding vision of the United States itself? And so I greatly appreciate the fact that Santa Monica regularly has gatherings at which the entire community comes and we read the holy scriptures from different religions, and we celebrate all of the traditions, and we recognize that they are all speaking one truth and encouraging us to the unity of the human family, to understanding and cooperation, to love and friendship, to building an ever-advancing society. Now, the reason that we gather this morning is sad and it is complicated. And I don't want to belabor the sadness, but I do want to lay a foundation for us to understand it, and for a very simple reason. You cannot solve a problem unless you can talk about it. And you cannot talk about it wisely unless you're informed. So what I wanted to do was just share some of the things that I'm learning and share some of the observations that that I've made and that I've read from others and that I've heard from others that might help us build an understanding that would reinforce our efforts to build the kinds of communities we want, communities that are based on justice and love, communities in which everyone is regarded as an honored member, communities in which we uplift the children and the youth and the families and carry and provide the kind of foundation that allows them to build a life that is healthy and dignified. And so I just want to make some observations about this and with an emphasis on what we're learning from this process. The first is this. You all know the tragic story of the church in Charleston. And you know that it was a Bible study class, and people had gathered, as they did routinely every week, to read the Bible and to strive to deepen their understanding of what God was telling them about how they ought to live their lives and what they ought to strive for by way of knowledge and habits of the heart and habits of engagement of others. And one night they welcomed in a stranger, a young white man who wanted to join the Bible study, and he turned out to be a purposeful killer, inspired by nothing but the disease of racism. And his intent was twofold. One was to slay all of the people in that Bible study. And the other was to start a racial holy war. That was his intent. Now, this came on the heels of a number of other very sad, very tragic, and very similar events all around the United States. And the truth of the matter is, while these events happened in rapid succession, they're not new, and they never disappeared. You know, if we go back a few years, we remember a man, Robert Byrd, walking home from a fishing hole when he was stopped by some men who decided they were going to lynch him that day. And they did. But here's what I wanted to emphasize. While these events are occurring, they are occurring less frequently than they had been. We are more concerned about them, more knowledgeable about them, and more determined that we're going to put a stop to all of the injustice perpetrated against any member of our community. And that is why it's so important that we gather together and have these kinds of discussions. I want to focus for a moment on learnings from Charleston, and then I want to talk a little bit about some of the implications of this. One of the things that I want to point out is how difficult it was for the members of that congregation to build that church and to become the people that they had been. I remember going into South Carolina the very first time I ever went. I was 18 years old. I was born and raised right here in Los Angeles. And I had gone to school at the University of Massachusetts, and we were going south for what was my first time in the South. And we reached the Carolina border, and there was a small sign that said, "Welcome to the great state of South Carolina." And it was signed by the governor of the state. And right in back of that sign was an enormous billboard. And on the billboard was a white horse and a member of the Ku Klux Klan. And this billboard, which was probably from that wall to that wall and from ceiling to floor, you could not miss it, even from a distance, said, "Welcome to the great state of South Carolina, the home of the Christian Democratic Ku Klux Klan." And I thought to myself, this is not L.A. I don't know anything about this, but I'm not feeling warm and friendly. And it was in that environment that the members of the Charleston church grew, founded a church, got an education, developed their lives, were elected to public office, became teachers in school, became doctors in hospitals, in an environment that was fundamentally adverse to their occupation of that space. And yet they found the spiritual fortitude to carry on. And when they were brutally murdered in their own church, in the midst of worshiping God and studying His Word for how they lived their lives, the response of their relatives and friends, the response of the members of the congregation, was to express their faith in God, their love for humanity, and their forgiveness for the man who had murdered their husbands, their brothers, their sisters, their wives, their children. And this transcendence of faith over grief, of the ability to set aside my personal anguish and desperate sense of loss, and to reestablish my faith in God and my determination to live by a standard that will not be defined by the injustice carried out against me, but will be defined by the standards by which I choose to live, is a lesson that we must all take to heart. We will not be defined. None of us here, none of us anywhere, will be defined by the things that happen to us. We will be defined by how we choose to respond to the things that happen to us. One of the interesting principles in all religions is that God does not test a soul beyond that soul's capacity to endure. And we have the book of Job, and we have so many other didactic lessons from the holy books and from religious history that tells us that God is merciful and kind, and he tests our faith, but not beyond our capacity. But you know what he doesn't say? He doesn't say that other human beings won't test us beyond our capacity. He says that God will be merciful and kind, and he'll be sensitive to our capacities and to our limitations. But he doesn't say that other people will be merciful and kind. But he does say that when injustice is visited on your life, you have to make some decisions about how you're going to respond. And in the example of the response of the congregation at Charleston, what we see is a true model of spiritual transcendence that is the highest expression of their faith in God and their belief that although this is a completely despicable act that is unthinkable and brings lifelong grief, the kind of grief you can't outrun, I choose to respond by reasserting my faith and by reasserting the standards by which I have chosen to live my life. Now, the reason that I want to emphasize that lesson is that that is the very spirit in which this nation was established. And it is a spirit that I think gives a special mission to this nation. In fact, I'll tell you that in the Baha'i teachings, the nation of America has a special spiritual destiny, because it is the home of the entire world. The American people are made up of every people on earth. And the Baha'i writings say that eventually America will make contributions to lead the world to unity and peace and to become a symbol of the oneness of humankind. But you and I both know that there's going to be a powerful lot of change between where we are and where we'll need to be in order to be that shining example of unity and oneness of all humankind. But when this nation was founded, the founders articulated a vision, and I'm not even sure they were aware of what was coming out of their mouths. But people said things like, if you spill a drop of American blood, you spill the blood of the entire world, because this is a nation made up of every people on earth. They said, we have it in our power to begin the world all over again. The past is the textbook of tyranny, but the future is the Bible of the free. And no less a personage than George Washington, who was a slave owner, and he owned a lot of slaves, said that the bosom of America is open to people of all races, nations, and religions, that we may make one nation, one race, and one religion. That's what he said. Now, I don't think that they understood the full implications in the way that we understand them. And I will tell you that I think that they were inspired by a sense of a fundamental turning point in human history. Because, as you know, this nation was founded with a contradictory set of values. On one, liberty and justice for all. On the other, we enshrine slavery in the Constitution. But I'll tell you what I think was important about that. It is a fact of human history that every nation on every continent in the world had slaves. And in every part of history, slavery was a constant. It is enshrined as a legitimate institution in the Bible and in the Quran and in other holy books. And what is important to me about this is that it bothered them, that it was the beginning of an awakening. And that awakening was that there cannot be differences among people. One of the great religious leaders of that time, George Fox, who was a Quaker in the old world, wrote a letter to all of the Quakers in the new world, and he said, "I've been thinking about the implications of starting a new world." And he said that I've been pondering what it means to establish a people, a place that would truly offer freedom and justice for all, in which all people would be considered equal. And he said to them that I've concluded that if God is just, it is not just to own another human being. Now, the Quakers who received that letter, and just imagine, there was no Twitter, there was no Facebook, there was no email, and there wasn't even old-style long distance. So these letters came by boat. They took a long time to get there, and they took a long time to be distributed. But the people took this idea to heart, and within the next 15 years, every Quaker in the New World, and they were among the richest plantation owners in the colonies, and they owned thousands of slaves. And what the Quakers did at that time was they divided their lands among the slaves who had helped develop their prosperity and gave them land in accordance to the amount of investment they had in that land. And they took a spiritual position based on this principle of justice and equality and said, we're going to live differently, and slaves are not going to be a part of that. That's why the Quakers became the leaders of the abolitionist movement. Well, when it comes to George Washington, who only emancipated his slaves at the point of his death, what is significant to me was that it bothered him enough to know that it was a fundamental injustice, and it was the beginning of an awakening that spread and ultimately culminated in the Civil War, which ostensibly was started because to maintain the unity of the states and to maintain economic prosperity. And what did Lincoln say at the end of the war? He said, we started it for one reason, but in the middle we learned that we were actually fighting it for another reason. He said, we started it to preserve the Union and to preserve our economic prosperity, but we learned that what we were really doing was testing the proposition that a nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all human beings are created equal can long endure. It was a fundamental question of whether or not we can build a nation in which every human being matters. So we have evolved significantly since those days, but not enough. And what I want to talk about today is what the current manifestations of those forces that we must resolve are. You know, what are those things that are holding us back? And how do they impact the development of populations? And what effect are they having on social organizations like cities and states? So I want to talk about where that bias comes from, how it manifests itself, its effect on people, and what it does to our capacity as cities to govern ourselves. And then I want to talk about how we transform that and how that transformation is working. And I want to say some things that I think will be surprising to you. And last, I want to mention a few things about the transformation of the individual. Because, you know, this is not a program that can be started by governments and states and so forth. At a certain point, individuals have to change. We have to take initiative. We have to call ourselves to account. we have to search our own hearts, and I want to talk a little bit about that. But first, I want to tell one more story. You all know the litany of stories about assaults on black women and men that resulted in their death and that were all inexplicable. Just how did that happen? We see it on, you can see it on video on YouTube. You can see it on television. But one that caught my attention was a story of a 29-year-old black father who was a fourth grade teacher. And he was taking his four-year-old son for daycare at his mother's house. Outside his mother's house, he was confronted by the police, asked why he was in that neighborhood, and beaten. And he was beaten in front of his son. And his concern at the time was not just that he was being brutalized. You know, here's a teacher on his way to teach fourth graders and depositing his four-year-old son at his grandmother's house, and there he is in front of his son being beaten and helpless to defend himself. And his concern was not the extent of his own injuries. His concern was, what am I going to tell my son about living in this world? Those lights came on, but they're blinding. If we could take them back down, that would be very nice. Thank you. What am I going to tell my son about this? And after he pulled himself together and dressed his wounds and calmed his son, who was hysterical at the sight of his father being beaten, because the man wasn't arrested, he hadn't committed any crime, he had threatened no one, he was unarmed, he was simply on his way to teach school. And he had a long talk with his son, and he said, you know, his son wanted to know why this had happened and who these men were and why they did this to him and so on. And he explained that there are people who use good judgment and people who use bad judgment. People who do good things and people who do bad things. And that we should not judge all of the police because of what happened to me. Now this is the epitome of grace. Because what this man is doing is trying to prepare his son to be fair-minded in the midst of injustice. He's trying to give his son hope for a different kind of social life in the midst of an experience in which social life has turned against him and actually threatened his life. This is a testament of his moral courage and his ability to do a kind of moral reasoning that would protect the best interests of the spirit, the character, and the understandings his son grew up with. Because, you know, that kind of experience can be permanently traumatizing to a child. So what I'm saying is this. In the case of this 29-year-old teacher who found a way to help his child digest an experience that might have marred him for life. In the case of the Charleston congregation, who found a way to let faith triumph over grief so that they could carry on and become an example to our nation. We ourselves, if we are to resolve this issue and establish universal equality and fairness for all people, have to assume a personal responsibility. It's not adequate that they did it for us. We have the model of Charleston's grace and forgiveness, but that doesn't apply to us. We simply learn from it and are inspired by it. We have the model of this young father, but his heroism is not ours. We must find ways in our own lives to manifest our own points of principle. These are the standards that I live by. I won't be defined by others. I'll be defined by my application of those standards to the events of my life. So that's the context in which I want to make some remarks. The first is this. There's a scholar at the university the University of Chicago named Kevin Massey. He is a white sociologist who was a colleague of one of the great sociologists of this nation, a black man named Bill Wilson. And Kevin Massey wrote a book called American Apartheid. And the issue was to find out whether the significance of race was declining or whether race continued to be a factor in the opportunities we had to lead a healthy and dignified life, to get education, to get a job, to buy a house, to buy a car. And what he found was that there was a interlocking set of individual actions, of institutional practices, of government policies that create a kind of cultural segregation that is so intense that he called it an American version of apartheid. Here are some of the observations that he made, and I think you'll begin to see the implications. He said, first of all, when it comes to our engagement with the police, that is, the engagement of African Americans with police officers, it is a sad fact that half of the black men under 23 years old will be arrested, and that 70% of black men without a high school diploma will be put in jail for one reason or another. The gateway offense will always be a traffic stop. Not in 100% of the cases, but in the overwhelming majority of the cases, it'll be a traffic stop. And the incarceration will generally result from the prior traffic stop. So your license plates weren't there, or you ran a stop sign, or what have you. I happened to serve as a consultant to the California State Supreme Court when it was establishing the Commission on Race and Ethnic Bias in the state of California. And the issue was how that commission would function and what we know about how race and ethnic bias is manifest in the justice system. And so several studies have been done around the United States in various states, including California, to understand better what race and ethnic bias looks like when it's manifest in the justice system. And here is the net. In every state in which it was studied, the differences in who is arrested, what the extent of their sentences are when they're how often they get convicted, and the length of their sentences is driven by race and color. And the standards are so clear inside the institutions that it was found that members of those institutions, that is, police, court officials, and so on, who are people of color, often continue to reflect the dominant discriminatory values of the institution itself as a way to protect their own membership. But you can see how that would affect anybody of color who was coming into engagement with the police or engagement with the justice system. The assumptions would work against you. I remember when I was a freshman in high school, a freshman in college, I bought a junker from my mother. It was the first car I ever had. It was one of those cars where it looked great, but the truth is it was a bucket of bolts. And, you know, just keeping the thing up and going forward was a big challenge. But it looked nice. And I remember how frequently I got arrested for Grand Theft Auto of my own car. And so I began to engage in the practice of carrying the pink slip with me so I didn't have to go through all the rigmarole with the police. Now, I wasn't speeding. I hadn't run a red light. I was just driving the car, and somebody decided I wasn't supposed to be driving the car. But it happened so frequently that I thought, well, you know, let me just get the pink slip so I can shorten the amount of time I have to deal with this discussion, because I know that I'm going to continue to be stopped. When my son was 9, we lived in Wilmette, Illinois. Now, Wilmette at the time was the wealthiest single set of neighborhoods in the continental United States. So it's very upscale. So here's my 9-year-old son riding his bike home from school, and he is stopped by a police car, and that is the car swerves in front of him and stops his progress. This is a 9-year-old boy, and he's asked where he got the bike, and he's confused. Miles is confused. He says, "This is my bike." He says, "Where do you live?" And he gives the address. And the officer says to him, "That's not possible." And so here you have a policeman, a 9-year-old boy, and an old mountain bike, kitty size. And the way this gets resolved is Miles, the 9-year-old, asks the policeman if he knows Officer Smith of the Wilmette Police Department. And the officer says, "Yeah, I know him, but how do you know him?" He says, "Well, he comes to our school, Wilmette Elementary School, and talks about the importance of looking both ways when you cross the street and not taking drugs and this and that and the other." So it's the 9-year-old who does the reasoning. And when I talked to the chief of police about this, and we visited, and I said, you know, I said, "George, you know, had a bike been stolen?" He said, "No." I said, "Well, when was the last time a bike was stolen in Wilmette?" He said, "About 4 years ago." So we don't really have a history of bikes being stolen in Wilmette. And there had been no report of a bike being stolen in Wilmette. And yet, my son, coming home from elementary school, is stopped, and he's questioned about his own bike. And he's a 9-year-old. I mean, how many 9-year-olds come to Wilmette to steal bikes? So, what we worked out, you get my point. This was completely driven by the fact that there was a black kid in a white village. When Miles and I left the village, when we drove out of town, 2/3 of the black male population left the village when we drove out. And that was the deal. When it comes to schools, the challenge for black kids is the same. When I was in the second grade, we had 3 reading groups: the Blue Jays, the Redbirds, and the Gophers. Gophers, not a bird, not an animal that lives above ground. Animal that lives in a hole underground in darkness. How did we decide who was who? I'll give you a hint. There was no testing involved. There was no assessment of academic ability or reading skills. The teacher, who happened to be black, by the way, said that the best dressed and best kept girls would be Blue Jays, and the second tier, in her estimation, would be Redbirds, and all the little black boys would be Gophers. And that was our assignment in life. Same teacher gave me an F for spelling, despite the fact that I had hundreds on all my spelling tests. And when my mother asked her about it, she said, "Well, He can spell great, but his handwriting is terrible, but we don't have a grade for handwriting, so I just gave him an F for spelling. But you see how this has the potential to steer you in a direction in which your development as a human being has distinct limits decided by somebody else quite arbitrarily simply because of color. Fast forward to Chicago today. There are about 500,000 kids in the Chicago elementary schools. There are about 100,000 kids in the kindergarten and first grades of the Chicago schools. 85% of those kids are black. 85% of those kids are below the poverty level, although not all the kids below the poverty level are black. 70% of the black kids do not know their last name, can't tell you. So, well, I'm Joey. Well, Joey who? I don't know. I'm Joey who lives with so-and-so. And the reason is generally because Joey's mom is 15 or 16 years old. And she has at least one, possibly two kids. 80% chance she's got two. And so these kids, who are the children of children, who have been disadvantaged all their lives, continue to compound all the difficulties of this intense cultural segregation and this assumption of limitations, and you know what you get. You get dispirited, you get chaotic, you get acting out, you get frustrated, you get low achievement, you get great unhappiness, you get the collapse of family, and you get the deterioration of community life. If we look at work, the University of Auburn did a study on how people make decisions about who gets hired and who gets promoted. Now, this is the Freeman School of Business at the University of Auburn. And they coined the phrase called the new racism, because what their research demonstrated was who you hire or who you promote tends, in 85% of the cases, tends to be somebody who looks just like you. But you won't say, well, you know, Jamshid is, you know, he was from Iran, and, you know, and he's different from, you don't say that because that's politically incorrect. So what you say is, I'm not sure that Jamshid would be happy in our culture, in the culture of our organization. I'm not sure Bob is a good fit for the way we do things here. Same assessment, same result, better language. But the limiting effect of racial bias has the same effect as it did before. We all know about redlining. When you go to apply for a house or an apartment, that people of color are steered to certain neighborhoods, that getting a mortgage or a loan approved is more difficult. We think that redlining stopped in the 60s with the Civil Rights Act, but it's alive and well today, as studies tell us. And black families who have saved their money and worked their jobs and done all the things that they should do still have a significantly greater difficulty getting the loan that they can afford for the house they want to buy. In healthcare, the American Medical Association released a study that said that white nurses and doctors under-medicate black patients who are in pain as a result of a painful disease or a catastrophic accident. And the reason they concluded was that these nurses and doctors simply don't feel their pain. So they are chronically under-medicated. This might explain why Eric Garner, a 43-year-old black man on Staten Island, who is selling individual cigarettes, a crime, no doubt, but this is an unarmed man who has not assaulted anyone, is surrounded by five policemen who ultimately jump him, choke him to death. He is laying on the ground, and he says 10 times, "I can't breathe." And no one responds to his call for help. Don't feel your pain. In Texas, a law was just passed that requires a certain kind of voter ID. Now, the specific intent of this law was to make it difficult for black and brown people to vote. And the reason that they wanted to make it difficult is that they tend to vote Democrat, and Republicans made the law. So this disenfranchises 1.2 million potential voters. That's a very significant. But here's the thing that's interesting to me. In Texas, if you have a student identification, that is not sufficient for you to register to vote. You have to have a driver's license. And if you don't have a driver's license, if you have a gun permit, you can register. Not with the student identification, but you can register with a gun permit. So in the case that was featured in a story in the New York Times, here's a young lady. She's 18 years old. She's graduated from high school, but she can't afford to go to a four-year college. But she's bright and she's industrious, so her decision is to go to a junior college. In order to do that, she's got to take an elaborate system of buses because she lives in the sticks and the junior college is far away. And she works in a restaurant and this and that and the other, but she can't afford to buy a car and she doesn't have a driver's license. But what she's got is two part-time jobs and a full-time load at the junior college and a student identification, and she can't vote. All she'd need to do is get a gun permit, and then she'd be able to vote. So I have just a couple of other examples, but the reason that I'm giving you these examples is not to depress you. It is to elevate our understanding of the comprehensiveness of the effect of racial discrimination. So here are some other examples. As Jeff Sheed mentioned, I was heavily involved in the President's Commission on Race. And one of the things that I was involved in was a series of panels that was held around the country on toxic waste sites. And the issue was, where are they deposited and how does that process work? Well, I'll tell you where they're deposited. They're deposited in black neighborhoods in playgrounds. This is where the waste is deposited. And the reason that they're deposited there is that the producers of the toxic waste fund the building of the playground, but the money they invest is in exchange for being able to bury toxic waste under the asphalt. Now, not surprisingly, there are cancer clusters of 5 and 6-year-old kids in all those places. So if you want to look for explosions of inexplicable outbreaks of certain kinds of cancer, you just follow all the maps where those toxic waste bins are underneath the playground, and you'll find kids who've got strange lumps on their neck. And I tell you what, when you sit and meet those mothers who are watching their children wither and die at 5 and 6 years old, and then you look at the process, and the process is very simple. What happens is you do hold a public hearing, but you put it in the microtype in the obituary section of the paper, that little type that nobody reads but old guys. and you say that at 11 o'clock on a Wednesday, we're going to have a hearing in a certain room in City Hall. And nobody can come at 11 o'clock because everybody's working. And nobody knows that it's happening because it's in the microtype and it's hidden from regular view. And so the deal is cut. The playground goes up, and nobody knows what's underneath the asphalt until there's an outbreak among children. There are two other examples that I want to mention, actually three. The first, it has to do with black farmers. One of my daughters got a PhD in history at the University of Chicago, and her master's thesis was an analysis of the effect of the ideology of white superiority on law from the Civil War up. And what she said was that because of this belief in white superiority, when the Civil War was over and the freed slaves were then subject to fair and equal treatment by the laws that were written for them were not fair and equal. They were discriminatory. And in fact, we know that even Confederate soldiers got a better deal. American Indians got a better deal. But the 40 acres and a mule, or even just equal protection under the law, was not available to black people. So shortly after this paper was written, a group of black farmers who had sued the United States for discrimination in how farming assistance was being distributed by the federal government won their suit, and they had and the Government Services Administration, the GSA, came back, and its finding was identical. They said that this has been a set of practices that have evolved since the Civil War and have followed into modernity, and they affect how black farmers were treated then and now, but they've also had an influence on welfare policy, on the development of law, and so on. And so you can see how this disease and how we look at human quality has infected the way our justice system works, the way our schools work, the way our housing work, even the way we apply for loans, or the way government policies are applied to different people. So what has the effect been on black people? Black people of a certain age would tell you that black people do not commit suicide. Black people of my generation would tell you in a heartbeat, nobody commits suicide. Life is hard, bad things happen, injustices are everywhere, but we don't commit suicide. And that was measurably true for almost 300 years, until the mid-1990s, where there began an epidemic of black suicide. And I don't mean poor people. I mean black people from rich to poor began to kill themselves in numbers that were completely unprecedented in the history of black people in this country. And the great psychiatrist, the Harvard psychiatrist Alvin Poussant, wrote a book called Lay My Burden Down, in which he said that it was the exhaustion of hope that was killing people. It was the exhaustion of the ability to carry the burden of normality. So you get educated, you get a job, you raise your family, and so forth, but then you've also got all these extra burdens. Can't get the job you want. Harder to get a mortgage. Harder to get anything to work the way it's supposed to work. And all the time, all the while, I've got to look normal. Because you can't walk through life bent. And so essentially what Alvin Poussant's conclusion was that the people couldn't carry the burden anymore. And they were simply laying their burdens down. This is not the America we want. This is not the condition of life that is healthy for anyone, including the nation at large. And you know what the irony is? The irony is The Economist magazine, which is the Bible of conservative economic analysis, wrote a very lengthy article on the American economy in the 2009 economic crisis. And they said that one of the major factors hindering the recovery of the American economy was America's habit of locking up disproportionate numbers of black men. And then they detailed all the economic effects of that practice on the national economy, and they were huge. The numbers were huge, and the effects were devastating. The irony of this is that Head Start costs about 2% of what it costs for us to give you welfare over a long period of time. All the remedies are a fraction of the price. And we know exactly what the remedies are. We know Head Start works. We know meal programs in school work. We know so many things about exactly what to do. And yet we have this belief that folks ought to pull themselves up by their bootstraps, that somehow, you know, their lot in life is their fault and they ought to fix it, with no acknowledgement that the challenges faced by people are far more complicated than the challenges faced by white members of society. And interestingly enough, one of the things that Kevin Massey concluded in his analysis of American apartheid is that it's not race that drives discrimination, it's color. So a person of any race who is darker will be treated less well than a person of any race who is lighter. That's the cultural reality. So I wanted to lay this foundation of understanding, because I think that it's important for us to understand that it is not sufficient for us to come together and sing Kumbaya. That's a starting point, and it is important. We've got to make friends of different races and begin to build interracial communities and organizations and so forth. But that's not enough. It's got to translate into policies and systems and institutional practices and the way that we manage our communal affairs in order to eradicate the burden of race from all of our shoulders. And here I'm describing race as the collective racial discrimination as the collective possession of the entire community. Now, with that as a foundation for how race affects life today, let's talk about the prospects for change. And let's talk about how change is advancing and why we should believe that we are not in the middle of that process or even advancing toward the other side, but in fact, there's light at the end of the tunnel, and the end of the tunnel is close. So I'm going to make that case. The promise of America is to begin the world all over again. What did Thomas Paine say? We have it in our power to begin the world all over again. The past is the textbook of tyranny, but the future is the Bible of the free. If that's true, and if that's going to come to pass, it means that we have to gain a fundamental understanding of what the path to happiness and greatness is. In a Baha'i context, one of the Baha'i writings says that the happiness and greatness, the rank and station, the pleasure and peace of a human being is not dependent on material possessions, on social influence, or on social status. They are rather dependent on the scope of your learning, the refinement of your character, and your ability to solve difficult problems. So we're going to talk about broadening the scope of our learning, refining our character, and increasing our capacity to solve difficult problems as individuals and as a community. In the Baha'i faith, the fundamental principle of our faith is the oneness of humankind. That is the belief that all human beings are equal in the sight of God and must be treated with respect, with dignity, with affection by each other. That the policies and laws, the institutions and the services that we provide to one must be available to all. And in fact, in the Baha'i teachings, it is clearly stated that if any segment of society is disadvantaged, then the bias that should be shown is assistance to lift them up and to help them repair the deficiencies in their lives. We also believe that this process of change in the society as a whole begins with change in the initiative and character of the individual members who compose society. It's an interactive process. It's true. We've got to initiate all kinds of things in our governments, in our town councils, with our police, and so forth, and we are doing that. But we've also got to assume new responsibilities as individual people. First, to assess our own hearts and ask ourselves, to what degree do I see people as equal to me, as deserving the same rights and privileges as everyone else? To what degree have I rid myself of bias that might influence the way that I engage members of the community who are different from myself? In the Baha'i writings, freedom from prejudice is referred to as the supreme injunction of the Baha'i writings and the hallmark of a true Baha'i character. And we are asked to look at every aspect of our lives, our children at play, our time at work, our membership at clubs, our leisure time, organizational affiliations, every aspect of our lives, and achieve this standard. We understand that it is not simply a progressive social understanding that will help society advance, although it is and it will. But we also see it as one of the commands of God, that He loves us all equally, and we must build a civilization that supports us all equally. So let's look at how we're doing. I want to suggest that one of the major transformations that is occurring right now is that ordinary people are doing extraordinary things, and that those ordinary people, invisible as they are bringing about profound changes in all the areas that I described. The last time I was here, I told you some stories about models of unity. And models of unity was simply, it was simply the outcome of a reaction I had to a report on hate crimes in Chicago. I'm friends with the Commissioner of Human Relations there. Every year he makes a report on hate crimes, and every year the data is the same. There's more hate crime today than there was yesterday. And I said, you know, there's got to be another side of this story. There's got to be some people getting along, and we ought to go find them and find out what they're learning. And he said a very interesting thing. He said, no, we can't do that. I said, well, why not? You know, we can mobilize some folks, and we can develop a measuring instrument, and we can assess various aspects of the community. He said, no, we got the capacity, but we can't do it. And I said, well, why? He said, because people would laugh at us. I said, help me understand that. He said, you know, if we produce a report on hate crimes, people will take that very seriously, and they'll believe the outcome. But if we come back and we say that there are these evidences in the growth of social cooperation, it's a feel-good story, and it might grace page 9 of the newspaper, but it's not going to carry any weight. I said, well, let's do it anyway, and let's see what we find. And we did. And what we found was that it is true that hate crime is unfortunately widespread. But there's another truth that nobody realized, that interracial, interethnic, and international cooperation is wider spread and deeper. And we found evidence not only throughout Chicago, in a religious community, in the education community, in government, in big business and small business, in neighborhoods, in every area of life, of social life. We found examples of interracial communities, all poor, where the community had been taken over by gangs. They knew that the Mayor's Crime Intervention Task Force, Gang Intervention Task Force, wasn't going to eradicate the problem, and one day a child was badly hurt. And so the parents did the unthinkable. They came out of their houses and they said, we got to do something about this neighborhood. And so what they did was they got together and they figured out that they would organize their work shifts so that there could always be chaperones on the street when kids are there. They took the playground, which had become gang headquarters, and they refurbished all the jungle gym and repainted the lines and put the basketball stuff back together and created a little league for the kids to play at, and they took back their neighborhood. And interestingly, within 8 months, a gang-dominated, crime-infested neighborhood had zero violence and zero crime. And not a shot had been fired. It was simply an interracial group of parents coming together over their common concern about their kids that had led them to do the things that neighbors do, to establish an inclusive, interactive, and unified neighborhood. And once that group got a sense of the power of their cooperation, they began to think about other institutions where they were not getting a fair shake with their kids. You know, we got issues with the schools. Let's talk about what they are, and then let's send a delegation of our neighborhood to talk with the principal at the school. And let's go down to the clinic where we get treated and talk about how we want to be treated. And over and over and over again, we were able to find transformational examples of people. We found two people, a black Baptist church and a white Baptist church that used to be the same. But when it was the same, the black folks had to come in the back and the white folks came in the front. So they separated. And they were brought together by three friends, two Baptists and a Baha'i, who said, you know, we all believe in the same Christ. We ought to come back together. And you should have seen. I saw it with my own eyes. People leaving out of the black church and people leaving out of the white church to meet in the middle of Evanston, Illinois, weeping and embracing one another and starting a process of reconciliation that changed that city. Or the Cabrini Greens project, where a very rich partner in an accounting firm lived right down the street from Michael Jordan, went into Cabrini Green, one of the fiercest ghettos in Chicago. And every day, he had knee pads, he'd show up about 5 o'clock, and he would work on a patch of dirt between the project buildings. And every day he was cleaning the dirt. He was taking all the detritus, the broken bottles and the tin cans and all the stuff that gets into dirt, and just cleaning the dirt. And nobody bothered him because they thought he was crazy and they thought that they feared that insanity was contagious. And yet he came so routinely that kids started to help him. And when he finished cleaning the area, he planted shishi vegetables, reduccio, arugula, basil, in the projects. And the kids helped him. And gradually, he reached out to Charlie Trotter, who was the number one chef in the world at the time, and a Wilmette native, and they cooked up a deal to sell these vegetables from Cabrini Green to Charlie Trotter's restaurant. Long story short, 15 years later, they incorporate. And they incorporate from a kid who had gone to college on the proceeds of the vegetables sold by this little project called Cabrini Greens. All the kids who worked got a college fund distribution from the vegetables that were sold. And over the years, they were able to send hundreds of kids to college from this little project to grow Reduccio and arugula in the projects. By this time, they had regional distribution, they had a fleet of vans, and they had a corporate attorney who himself had grown up in Gerbini Greens picking arugula and basil. One guy. Hundreds of lives changed. Ordinary people doing extraordinary things, bringing transformational impact. So the point that I wanted to make to you is that this is not a phenomena of a few feel-good stories in Chicago. In fact, we did these studies in 60 cities around the United States, and we found that it was everywhere. The problem is we simply don't pay attention to it. So let me move toward conclusion by reinforcing this with another larger change that is occurring in the world right under our noses. We think that this is one of the most violent periods in human history. And we think that because every time we turn on the television or read the newspaper, somebody died and they died bloodily. And somebody took a gun to the movies, or they shot up the post office, or they killed their boss because they got fired. There's a man named Steven Pinker. He's a social psychologist at Harvard University. And he wrote a book called The Better Angels of Our Nature. Bad boy is 900 pages. It is heavier than the Bible, for crying out loud. The book makes the documented case that we are right now living in the most peaceful time in the history of the human species. And that while violence has not been eliminated, it has been virtually eliminated compared to all other periods of human history. Now, the way this is measured is deaths per 100,000. So how many deaths per 100,000? I'll give you a baseline measure. During World War II, we had about 500 deaths per 100,000 people in the population on a global basis. You know what it is right now worldwide? It's less than one. It's less than one. And when you look at where the violence has been reduced, it is everywhere. Reductions in family violence, reductions in violence against children, reductions in violence against other people in society, reductions in regional conflicts, reductions in international conflicts. We're living in the longest period of sustained peace in the modern world. It's called the long peace. It's the time from World War II till today. Now, none of this guarantees that there won't be a war tomorrow. But what it does say, when we look at why these changes are occurring and what they might mean for any effort we make to push them forward, we can learn a lot about how we are beginning to civilize our communities on a global scale. What's driving this incredible reduction in violence on a global scale? I'll tell you, it's very easy. One, the rule of law. More countries have established justice systems that are following the rule of law. Second, the fact that governments are more stable, they tend to be more democratic and participatory, and they are longer, they're being sustained longer. Third, the fact of international cooperation. You know, there wasn't an African Union 50 years ago. There is now. With interactive relationships between all the African states and interactive relationships between the African states and the European states and the South American states and the American states and the Far Eastern states. The fact that we now have a global economy in which what happens here is fine, but the truth of the matter is if China's stock market tanks, if their currency is devalued, we're destabilized. It is that interactive, but one of the implications of that is no nukes, because I've got so much money of my money tied up in you that I can't bomb you without impoverishing myself. You see what I'm saying? There's such a degree of interaction and interinvestment that it has created an environment in which we disagree on a lot of things, but we're not about to blow each other up because it's too costly. But interestingly, terrorism, down. Terrorist attacks, down. And I don't mean a little bit down, I mean dramatically down. When I said violent deaths per 100,000, World War II, around 500, now less than one. That is incredible, and it's very difficult to believe. So I just want to make a few observations about that, and then I'll conclude, and hopefully we'll have some time for questions. The reason that I wanted to share this with you is that it is a part of a trend that is affecting the transformation of the cultural condition of the entire world. It is a result of the spread of education. It is the result of the spread of healthcare. It is the result of global economic interdependence and global economic interinvestment. It is the result of international cooperation, and it is the result of the development of justice systems, the rule of law, and so on. Are these systems perfect, and are they treating everybody well? No. Most of these systems are new, and they're shaky. Are they giving us a transformational result, a quantum increase in the level of peace in our societies? Absolutely. Number of children being victimized, dramatically down. Number of wives being beaten by husbands, dramatically down. And by dramatically, I mean astonishingly so. So the reason that I wanted to mention these things is to tell you that this isn't a vague and pious hope where we say, you know, I wish the world was better and I wish everybody had a better shake and this and that and the other, but it's just too big a deal for me to deal with and I'm just, what can I do? I'm just one person. I want to say exactly the opposite. I want to let you know we're in the gun lab of that is the final part of the race, where ordinary people are doing extraordinary things on a global scale. And every single thing you do to reach out to another person, to speak up in your civic activities, to be active in your faith community, to reach out and be service-oriented in your neighborhoods, everything you do advances that process to a degree which is astonishingly beyond what we would imagine is possible. So let us not come out of this thinking all these guys are being victimized. Look, I'll tell you. I was on the Roswell tennis team, Roswell, Georgia. Now, at the time, my kids were little. I just built my wife a house on a bluff overlooking the federal forest. It's the only tropical rainforest in the continental United States. It's breathtakingly beautiful. And Paula got the house she wanted. Problem was there was only one road leading to that spot because it was a unique spot. It was a unique area. So I'm playing tennis. I'm in my tennis stuff. And I come off the tennis court. We're done. I go home, and I discover there's this long parade, and it's blocking the only street that leads to my house. So I ask, I go around, park my car. I walk over to the policeman, and I say, look, I live on Kingsmill Court, and the parade is going by. How long is that going to be? Should I get a Coke, or should I go get lunch? And literally, that's my deal. I mean, I get that there's a parade, and it's little kids, and, that's good. Right? So is this going to be a long time, or is it going to be a little time? And he says a few things that were unpleasant. And I said, look, let's not go there. Just tell me how long the parade's going to be. I'll get a Coke or I'll get lunch. And he repeats some unpleasant things. And so I turn around to leave. He grabs me and the beating begins. And, all over my head with the billy club, ramming my head into the police car, into the trunk of the police car. And the trunk wasn't open. So it was particularly painful. And as the two policemen began to beat me, I could feel two completely different forces. One was my realization that they were losing control. I could feel it. That what started out to be annoyance had escalated into a kind of rabid hostility, and that was getting out of control. And I knew that I could die here. And the other thought I had was, I've got three kids and a wife who live on an isolated bluff with only one road in and one road out. I cannot raise a hand in defense without jeopardizing my family. I live in Georgia, in Roswell, Georgia, in a town that is next to the southern headquarters of the Ku Klux Klan. I can't fight these guys without jeopardizing my family. And so instantly it's clear to me there's going to be a licking given today, and it's going to be my head. And the reason that I point this story out is this. This is a common feature of the lives of most people of color. That kind of risk, that kind of exposure to danger. Nevertheless, what I said at the beginning of these comments holds true. It's not what happens to you. It's how you decide you're going to respond to what happens to you. And what I'm saying to you is, all of us have hurtful, unjust, unpleasant things that invade our lives and drive us to a place we don't want to be. But we are reaching a critical point in the history of human life on this planet, where if we keep coming to meetings like this and engaging discussions like these and reaching out to each other in new ways, we can bring about a transformational change in the condition of our culture that will not be limited to Santa Monica, but will spread worldwide. And the evidence of that is in Steven Pinker's book, The Better Angels of Our Nature. The evidence of that are in countless studies that have been done that show the transformational effect that people you will never know have had simply because they reached out to somebody else. So at the end of the day, we weep for Charleston, and we weep for all of the people who've been victimized unjustly simply because of the color of their skin. But we cannot limit our reaction to disgust or sadness. We must resolve to make ourselves different, to engage our community in a different way, to reach out in ways that broaden our own engagement of the advance of community life, and to enjoin the discussions that will lead to new understandings and new levels of cooperation and friendship. So I want to close with this idea. Revolutions never occur when things are good. They never have. They never occur when things are horrible. They occur when things have the prospect of getting better. So you look at all the revolutions, what incited those people to act was the opportunity to change. They saw, they felt that something could be different in society, and they were willing to stand up and be counted in order to advance that difference. That's exactly where we stand today. We have the opportunity to drive a change in society that will help this country, the promise of which was to begin the world all over again and to become the Bible of the free, so that it becomes a standard of unity and justice for all people that leads the world to a new level of life on a global scale. Thank you for your time and attention.
All wholehearted gratitude to you for taking the time to so profoundly address such an important issue. Thank you very much.
Friends, I know we are running a little bit behind, but it is important. Maybe we can all stay together, and while Dr. Henderson is here, maybe we can take the time for a couple of questions, and then we move on with some more music, and we meet next door. Let's just have just a couple of questions, if that's correct. Gary, please, go ahead. Bob, please, if you can.
Thank you for your words. I tend to ask this question every time I come to your presentation, because it's a common theme that I've been working on. Do you believe that by us creating a global community, global citizens out of our youth, we can help to overcome any of the issues that you brought up?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The question was, do I believe that by helping to create global citizens out of our youth, we can help to overcome? Listen, I was just, my wife and I were just in Italy at the Baha'i school there. And there were kids from 20 different countries. And these kids, you know, I was telling Jim Sheed, 9-year-olds and 7-year-olds who speak Chinese, Italian, Persian, and English flawlessly. And so dramatically that I asked little Luca, I said, Luca, your English sounds like you're from California, for crying out loud, but you live in China. I said, what language do you think in? He said, oh, I love to think in Chinese. I said, so you translate into Italian and Persian and English from Chinese? Oh, he said, oh, yeah. I said, but there's no alphabet in Chinese. He said, no big deal. You know, I got this. And I'm looking at these kids, and I'm realizing there is a fundamental difference in their cultural sensitivity, in their cultural flexibility, in their concept of who matters and who gets included, and their ability to understand the diversity of human experience. Absolutely. You invest in that, you get a different world. There's just no question about it. One other question right here.
Dr. Henderson, thank you for your words.
By the way, I go by Bob.
Bob.
It works really well.
Thank you.
You can say it backwards. It comes out the same.
Yeah, and I wanted to thank you for your perspective on ordinary people doing extraordinary things. I think that is so important and empowering. And I guess as I listened, you know, you started with the example of the Quakers early on, and that history of people working together to bring about unity has continued in this country, yet it's not as well known as the history of racism and violence. And I guess I wanted to get your perspective. You know, when you talked about things in the media, there's that old saying, if it bleeds, it leads.
Right.
And I just was curious on your perspective, what's it going to take to sort of change that and bring out these stories of ordinary people?
That's an excellent question. Excellent question. First of all, the reason that we believe that life is more dangerous and violent today than it was before is because that's what we see on television. That's what we read in the paper. And there's a psychological phenomenon called recency and frequency. That is, how recently you heard about a violent act and how frequently you hear about the violent act creates a sense of proximity. That is, danger is close to me. So I hear about it all the time. I just heard about it again. That must mean that I'm at risk here. But the truth of the matter is, that's not the whole story. It's not even part of the story. The real story is not the acts of violence, but those acts that do not occur and that are dying out, and the transformation of the community. That's the real issue. Now, there was a second part of your question, but I got caught up in the first part and I missed it.
What is your thought then on, because this history of people working toward unity has been there, and it's hard to find it in our school textbooks unless we really know where to look. And now the media tends to put out the stories.
Okay.
Even your colleagues said, well, we can't do the stories
exactly.
of ordinary people
exactly.
doing extraordinary.
So the answer to that question is, so if it bleeds, it leads. And if it's bad news, we hear about it 35,000 times, from CNN to the Santa Monica paper to the New York Times. Anything you look at is going to focus on the negative news. I'll give you a good example. The California drought. Y'all are out of water, right? Oh, look, wait a minute. I read an article in the New York Times not a week ago that said that you are recapturing virtually every drop you consume. That the conservation measures are doing such a good job that you're actually gaining in your water conservation. It was very encouraging. Have you heard that? Yeah. How about that? I live in Chicago. We got lots of water. I live right on the lake. I don't see anything but water. And here you are, and you don't even know that. And the most important thing for you to know is that all of your conservation technology is working. And you don't even know it. Same thing about this change. So, in answer to your question, what we did in Pasadena was to address that very point. And they created a standing article in the Pasadena Star that told stories of interracial cooperation, where people were coming together to solve problems that they had commonly. And it was just, you know, here's the news. Here's what we are doing for ourselves to change the condition of this community. And they had a cable access program that brought those stories to light, where they just bring people up and say, you know, what are you doing in the neighborhood, and this and that and the other. So, for example, when I did the assessment, I interviewed one of the members of the city council. And they said, and at the time, it was what? Was it Proposition 187? Is that right? That wanted to take illegal immigrants out of the school? So he said, you know, we know the Latino members of our community are unhappy with it, but they won't come to any of the city council meetings where they could talk about it. I said, well, why don't you go to the neighborhood? And why don't you have those meetings in Spanish? And lo and behold, they went to the neighborhood and they had the meeting in Spanish, and a whole lot of people came, and they had a lot to contribute to the discussion of how we change the, you know, knock, knock. So in Pasadena, one of the great effective things that was done was to tell the story of change in progress. Who's doing it? What are they doing? And to do it so routinely that it became a common part of the community's understanding. It's not just the bad news. Here are the things we're doing, and here's what we're learning from that, and here's how it's changing our institutional practices, or the conditions in our neighborhood, or the safety of children, or the opportunities that children have to pursue. And of course, the minute they began to do that and they sustained it, it gained momentum. So I'm told that we are really over time, so I'm going to just let it go. I'm sorry?
I had a question, but anyhow, time is over.
We'll take one more. We'll take your question, please.
My point is this, in the last
section of your talks now, that explanation makes everybody happy. But before that, I was really so sad that there are so many things is going on against the blacks and so on. And it reminds me of the talk of Abdu'l-Bahá he delivered to the gathering of the blacks in Washington, D.C. It was so marvelous. When he came and talked to them, he explained what the good things that the whites did for the black, to such extent that at the end of the meeting, the hearts of everybody was full of joy and happiness. That I think if you tell us more story about that getting together and working together, rather than focusing on the past things and the whole terrible things that has happened to you or the others, it brings more energy to the listeners, and we really be mm-hmm. very happy and joyful.
I really take your point. I really think that it's important that we emphasize those positive and transformational aspects. I want to add one element to your expression, and that is I want to suggest that this is a problem of a unique character in which we are so underinformed about the factors that cause these situations that we have to learn about them. We just have to, and it's unpleasant and it's difficult, but we have to understand what forces we're fighting. It's like when you go to the doctor, the doctor doesn't just tell you that he's going to make you well. He tells you what you got. And he says, you know, you got this and this and this, but the good news is we can fix it, but it's going to require a change in diet and exercise and medication and so on. In this case, we know the outcomes, but we don't know exactly what the disease is. We do have to have some understanding of what's causing this, and we also have to understand what the remedies are. So the effort, with apologies, was to provide you with a broader basis for understanding what's driving the inequality in our society and what's being done to transform that inequality. So here's the last thing I'll say on this subject. I believe in this interplay of crisis and victory. That is, when you have a crisis, it is an opportunity to have great leaps of progress by exactly the kind of response that you saw in Charleston, or that we visited in the case of the 29-year-old school teacher who was beaten in front of his son, where this is an opportunity to make a dramatic change in how we live our lives. And that's what I'm inviting you to consider. And if you take nothing away from this talk, take this idea. What you do, what you think, how you feel, the behavior you engage in matters. Every one of you can contribute to this process of change in ways that are far more impactful than you ever imagined. And the proof of that is in all the studies that have been done about what ordinary people do that affects extraordinary transformation and change. Thank you so much.